Hello, America, and welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune and Pastor Dusty White of Cormdale Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. Every Wednesday, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about election 2020.
Dun, 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 what's dun, up?
Decision 2020.
This one was teed up by some listener feedback. Actually, let me read another. I got a lot of listener feedback recently. Here's one I received. Hey, just want to say a quick thank you for the recent podcast you guys did on questioning systemic racism. It was very clarifying and helpful for me. It helped bring clarity on something I've been struggling through. I appreciate you guys. So that's cool. It's great to hear from listeners that the things we talk about are helpful. And then, as Mike always says at the end of the podcast, hey, send us your topic ideas, and people do that. And so here's an email from a listener read by our very own Cormdale intern, Travis Barrett.
Hi, Wednesday Conversation team. Thanks for sharing your thoughts through the weekly podcast. I appreciate your gospel-centered perspectives and recommendations for resources and how to engage with culture in thoughtful, meaningful, and appropriate ways. I found the conversations about race relations helpful and especially appreciated the episode on conspiracy theories. Too many loved ones fall down those rabbit holes, and your thoughts on the dangers of unfalsifiable claims was enlightening. With elections quickly approaching, news regarding political issues and candidates is inescapable. As I consider our options, I find the somewhat trite question from childhood going through my brain. What would Jesus do? It seems any decision will cede some biblically based values while upholding others. So who would he vote for? Would Jesus vote at all? We're often admonished that it's our civic duty to vote, but if our higher values are based in the kingdom of God, should we worry about engaging in our civic duties? In the Lord's Prayer, we ask, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven." Can we participate in bringing God's kingdom to earth through civic engagement and democracy?
Excellent question. Not the first listener to ask this question, not the first person in the church to ask this question. I'm getting a lot of questions related to election stuff because I think Christians are feeling the complexity of election season once again. And here are, let's just name the camps, shall we? There's the rah-rah Trump camp who are like, hey, you might not like Donald Trump, but doggone it, his policies have been decent, and so we should all vote for him. There's the never Donald Trump in a million years camp that's basically like, hey, this guy is poisonous, and we need to do everything we can to get him out of office and vote for his opponent. And then there's, I don't know, what other camps are there? There's the you're not even a Christian if you think people can vote for Donald Trump. Like, that's actually, I've talked to pastors lately who are like, hey, there's people threatening to leave my church because I won't tell people not to vote for Donald Trump. Like, so I think there's just a weird, the freedom we usually give one another to have some difference of opinion in this area seems like this election is like pinching all of that out of the room to where it's like, man, people are really convictionally polarized. And that's a little troubling. I understand it. Mm-hmm. I get why some of us are feeling that way. But what this listener's question made me realize is, hey, we should talk about some election stuff. And I also don't feel like I have a lot of clean answers.
No.
But this is a conversation. It's why we call it the Wednesday Conversation. It's not the Wednesday Answer
Just
podcast.
A little back and forth.
It's the Wednesday Conversation.
Would you say that if we went back to revisit all of our 2016 Trump episodes, that a lot of it could be the same.
It's basically just round two of that. Yeah. Round two of that.
Yeah.
But there were two interesting articles recently that I think what I want to do is engage the points of view of these two articles because I think they help us as Christians give us some points of conversation or some questions we should be asking as we think about our civic responsibility, which is what this listener is asking about. So many of you will be familiar with David French. He is a writer and author in Nashville, Tennessee. I think was almost a candidate for president last time around. There's people who wanted him to run. He's a well-known sort of conservative cultural commentator. He wrote an article recently called "Do Pro-Lifers Who Reject Trump Have Blood on Their Hands?" Because someone on Twitter told him, hey, if you don't vote for Trump, but you say you're pro-life, then you're responsible for whatever happens and you have blood on your hands. How could you not vote for a pro-life candidate? So he's writing to try to answer that question. The second article that I found interesting is in National Review, and it's by Robert George and Ramesh Panoru. The title of the article is called "Voting for Life: A Guide for the Perplexed." And their argument is, if you are a person of pro-life conviction, you do not have the option open to you to vote for Joe Biden. But it's a very nuanced argument they're making. It's actually really sort of rooted in Catholic social teaching. These are both Catholic writers. And so it's real interesting for me to read because I think it asks some questions that deserve some thought. So I know for a fact that there are people in our church, there are these two camps in our church. They're the people that are like, man, I'm pro-life, and that means hold my nose and vote for Trump, or rah-rah, vote for Trump. Don't even, you know, that just they're committed to the cause of pro-life movement. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, they would say you must vote for Trump.
Single issue. I'm a single issue voter. Right.
I also know people in our church who are so, I don't know what the word is to use, so disenfranchised with Donald Trump, so done with Donald Trump, tired of all of what is happening in our national society, that they are saying, hey, convictionally, I have to vote for Biden. And it has less to do with how I feel about abortion or how I feel about some of the social policies. It has to do with who Donald Trump is and what he's doing to our society, and maybe with some of the broader things he's saying about race and immigration and some of those things. So I know for a fact that there are listeners to this podcast who find themselves in both those categories. I want, as a pastor, just to tee up some questions for people in both those categories in a way that probably will make everyone mad. And that's great. And then we'll close in prayer.
It's going to make us all not want to vote at all.
So what you're saying at the end of this podcast, Bob, you will tell us who to vote for.
I will not.
By the end.
But I will give everyone your email address and tell them to email you with their feedback.
At minute 26, I think, is when he does
that's
that.
That's right.
We're going to wear him down.
Let's go.
Good luck with that. Here is the interesting. So David French is tackling the argument, hey, if you're pro-life, you have to vote for Trump, or you are instantiating abortion. And I had a conversation just recently with a member of our church who said, hey, I do not understand, if you are pro-life, how you could possibly do anything but vote for a pro-life platform. Forget the person, forget the personality, forget all the issues people have with people. What's the platform of the parties? That needs to define how we think as Christians. And there's some
just
truth.
Strictly policy.
Well, there's some truth to that because I think, you know, we are a personality-driven culture and we sort of get caught up in like, do we like this person? Do we not like this person? And sometimes it is good to say, hey, actually the policies do matter, you know? So, but this person was very adamant that, hey, if you are pro-life, there's no way you could possibly make another choice in this election. David French wishes to disagree with you. And here are his 5 points. He says, here's the simple realities about abortion in the United States. Number one, presidents have been irrelevant to the abortion rate. Mm-hmm. Number two, judges have been forces of stability, not change in abortion law. Number three, state legislatures have had more influence on abortion than Congress. Number four, even if Roe is overturned, abortion will be mostly unchanged in the U.S. And number five, the pro-life movement has an enormous cultural advantage. Here's the interesting case David French is making. He's saying, hey, the pro-life movement is winning. It doesn't matter what's happening at the ballot box. It doesn't matter what's happening with Roe versus Wade. It doesn't matter what's happening with abortion policy. What's happening is people in America increasingly see a baby as a baby. And that's a win for the pro-life movement. He's like, if we would stop putting all the focus on who we're voting for and what their policies are and acknowledge that, like, hey, actually, the pro-life movement is winning the day, it would really help relieve some of the anxiety in the room around every 4 years in November. Hmm. He posts a chart from the Guttmacher Institute, which is a socially liberal think tank.
Yeah, you like charts.
I love charts,
man. You like,
man,
the way this one is laid
it's,
out?
I mean, it's great. This one's beautiful.
You taught me a lesson one time on how charts mess with your mind.
They do. You can, I mean, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics, as Will Rogers said. I just swore on the Wednesday conversation.
First
podcast.
Time ever.
But the U.S. abortion rate reached a historic low in 2017. And David French says, hey, every time I show this chart, people say, yeah, but isn't that because the birth rate is declining anyway? And so, of course, the abortion rate is declining because the birth rate is declining. He says, nope, actually, the ratio of abortions, the number of abortions per 1,000 pregnancies is also declining. So he's like, across every category, all the statistics say rates of abortion are declining. That takes into account even chemical abortions and all the sort of new technology that allows people to terminate pregnancies. Taking all that into account, the abortion rate is declining. And so what he's saying is, hey, because that's true, and he's, this is a very well-substantiated article, he says also, it's a fact that presidents have almost no ability to move the needle on this. It's primarily a judicial and state legislature issue. And also, justices have actually been, over the last 40 years, a source of stability. If you look at how abortion decisions have been made, both in lower courts and at the Supreme Court, the justices have been very, very reticent to make any dramatic decisions. And basically what they've done is like adjudicate around how accessible is abortion. Is it okay to, you know, what if we have a law in our state that says you have to notify your parents? Is that okay? What if we have a law that says my doctor has to have admitting privileges at the local hospital? Is that okay? Those are the kinds of things they're deciding, which has no bearing on is abortion legal or illegal nationally. The justices are making very small scale decisions that have less to do with the topic of abortion as a whole and more to do with very fine tuned arguments about its accessibility.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting how he quoted or used the examples of Souter, Kennedy, and O'Connor as far as recent justices who, before they were on the Supreme Court, made very strong anti-Roe versus Wade statements about how it was bad law and did very destructive things to human life. And yet once they get on the court, they become notorious. He used the term squishes, like liberal squishes, where they didn't touch it. They didn't challenge it. And you see history repeating itself once again in recent court cases in history. You have John Roberts, who was supposedly this champion of, you know, conservative champion of life. And yet how is he ruled now that he's on the bench?
Pretty squishy.
Pretty squishy.
Yeah.
And I think this, in my opinion, I'm just going to go out and say, this is the best conservative leaning article of 2020.
Really?
Wow.
Why do you say that? This article, because I think it cuts through so much of the hysteria around this topic. And it also points to how, in a lot of ways, voting is more of a symbolic act than an actual functional change. Now, I'm not minimizing voting. I think there are voting has consequences. But on this issue, voting for president often is more of a symbolic thing. If you look at the history and look at the statistics and the way this plays out, and it's a great article, well substantiated, read it. So what I think this does is, for those people who want to make that strong assertion, you have to vote for Trump to support a pro-life cause, this article says actually your conviction is well put and well placed, but that vote for Trump is probably more symbolic than it is actually affecting change. Mm.
Yes. His fourth point is maybe the most controversial because it will make many people upset. He says overruling Roe. Let's say we overruled Roe versus Wade. Let's say this thing got overturned.
Isn't that what we want?
That's what we've been fighting for decades. Guess what? It will not change the vast majority of abortions in America. And the reason he says that is you still have a very polarized and divided electorate, and you still have highly state and local policies affecting these things. And so he says, look, support and opposition to Roe is spread across the nation. Whatever happens at the highest level, the fight is going to continue. It's not like everybody's gonna be like, oh, I guess abortion is illegal now. And you know, that we're gonna stop fighting.
We're done. Right? So we're done.
So he's saying, look, this is a systemic fight in America. It's entrenched, it's not going away. And overruling Roe would have the most effect in states that already have pretty good restrictions on abortion. And it wouldn't change things very much in states that have very liberal views on abortion.
So it's not the same as ending slavery in the U.S.
Correct.
Where it just eliminates it across the board. This is just kicks it back to the states.
Although the historians would say, and it didn't even eliminate it across the board. So bad comparison, yes. Chris.
Well, you know what I mean.
I know, but it's actually, argument. I know, I'm kidding.
It kicks it back to the states and makes it a little bit more illegal.
Correct.
Depending on local legislature.
Right, right.
And then, so it blocks me a little bit, but I still can find a way to have an abortion.
Yeah, where most abortions are happening, it's not going to be outlawed in those states. Right. And so hence his point.
Let me read a little quote from David French's article. I'm not arguing that national politics don't matter at all. A blue wave could end the Hyde Amendment and result in direct federal funding of abortions. The best available data indicates that it would result in more abortions, though it's far from clear that it would stop the overall decline in abortion rates and ratios. And that's a reason why pro-life Americans should resist a Democratic takeover of the Senate. But if you're pro-life, those things that matter most, your relationships and your local political community, are the things over which you have the most influence. the things that matter the least, the presidency and national politics, are those things most removed from your daily life. So he's saying, hey, who you vote for as president has almost zero bearing on abortion in America. So let's stop pretending that it does. And let's stop buying into this talking point that if you don't vote for a pro-life presidential candidate, you don't care about the reality of abortion. He's saying that that argument just doesn't hold water when you look at the data.
And take that energy and focus it where it does matter, which is at the local and state level.
Right. Now, so what I think is interesting here is I do want to make an appeal for Christians to be convictionally and passionately pro-life. I think this is just an issue that just deserves our conviction. And so I don't want us to be squishy as a church or as Christians on this issue. I just think, man, even the people who are very anti-Trump and who are like, man, Trump has been terrible for the world and we need to go an entirely different direction. I'm hopeful that those people are still recognizing, hey, and there's no way I can clap for the policies that make abortion easier or more accessible. This is a this is a grave moral evil. And if you're still in formation on that, on your thoughts on that issue, I hope you'll continue to read and study on that, because I do think it's critical that Christians be a loud and unified voice for the evil of abortion, which gets us now to the Robbie George and Ramesh Panuru article. Now, Robert George is a professor of jurisprudence at Princeton University. What does that tell you? A, he knows the law, and B, he's a really smart guy. All right, so he's a judicial scholar, and he is a convictional Roman Catholic, and I follow him on Twitter, and he's just a thoughtful, intelligent, great commandment kind of a guy. Like, just he's a really wonderful human being. But his article is written sort of from a specifically Catholic viewpoint. He's coming out of his own Catholic convictions, but he's saying, hey, so Joe Biden says he's personally opposed to abortion, but he supports it because it's the party's platform. And he's like, hey, this is kind of a thing that people do, that politicians do, to say, I'm personally opposed to it, but, you know, it's the policy of the land, and so I'm not going to overturn it.
Which is a really easy way of saying, like, I'm Catholic, so I oppose it, but I'm also a Democrat, so you know, whatever.
Yeah, which is what Joe Biden's doing. And Robert George is saying, hey, that's actually not an option that's open to any candidate, Joe Biden or anyone else, and here's why. Because the church, the Catholic Church that Joe Biden claims to be a part of, has spoken clearly on the moral evil of abortion. So they don't leave the option open to you to be personally opposed to it, but to not care what happens at the level of national policy. Here's some of the things that Robert George points out. And again, he's drawing on Catholic social teaching here. He says, for government to permit abortion, the church teaches, is for government itself to commit an injustice against its victims, denying a disfavored class, the unborn, protection it affords to all others. To be responsible or partially responsible for the injustice of the law in exposing unborn children to lethal violence is to be complicit in grave injustice. I think this is a really important point he's making here, because he's going to draw out later in this article why he feels like abortion is a different issue than, for instance, immigration or prison reform or some of those things. He's saying abortion is specifically a problem and should be an ethical problem for Christians, because it is the state, as the state, committing injustice against its own citizens. The state, by enshrining the law of abortion, is saying we call it legal and defensible and put our might and muscle behind the killing of our own citizens. And he's saying that is a dramatic injustice that is categorically different from some of the other things that people want to talk about and say, well, what about prison reform? What about immigration? What about all these other things? So he's saying this is a denial of basic human rights to one category of human beings, that category being unborn children. So his argument is you don't get the option, Joe Biden, of saying I'm personally opposed to it, but I'm okay with it at the level of policy. He draws a connection to slavery. He says, hey, if you're against slavery, you can't just be against it personally, but okay. He's like, if you're against slavery, you're either against it or you're not against it. And he's saying abortion is the same way. If we dial the clock back 150 years and like, well, I'm personally opposed to slavery, but I mean, it's the law of the land, so that's what it is. We would look back at that and go, yeah, that's, you can't do that. And he's making the same argument here. Now, here's the interesting thing. Robert George and Ramesh Panuru make two interesting things here that I think answer two of the questions I've been getting as a pastor. And the questions I've been getting relate to what is a Christian doing when they vote? Granted that we live in a country of 330 million people. So does my vote really matter? And if I don't vote, does it really matter? And how should I think about if I have two bad choices and I'm facing a lesser of two evils kind of opportunity, how should I think about my vote in that moment? And what he does is he sort of answers that question for us this way. To vote for a candidate for president is to have an infinitesimal
yeah.
effect.
Spell that.
Infinitesimal effect on the outcome of the election, but to wholly determine whom one wills to be president. So you hear what he's saying there? He's like, yep, you have a super, super minuscule effect on the outcome. But what you are doing by voting is determining who you will to be president, who you wish to be president. So it's not that your vote has a dramatic outcome on or effect on the outcome, but what you are doing by voting is saying, here's who I will to become president. And so you're joining your will with that candidate's will and saying, I will that what they will be done is kind of, and so he's saying, while one need not will all that the candidate one votes for endorses, one's choice must be in accord with the golden rule. The pro-lifer who votes against Biden may not keep him from winning. He will, however, at least refuse to join in tolerating a massive violation of human rights. This is true of the pro-lifer who votes for Trump. It is true as well of the pro-lifer who, moved by objections to President Trump, votes for a different pro-life candidate or for no presidential candidate at all. So he's saying, even if you choose to not vote, you're making a choice. You're making a decision that has ethical accord behind it. They go on to say, neither of us have endorsed Donald Trump. Both of us have been intensely critical of him. We do not claim that pro-life citizens have an obligation to vote for him. So going back to the conversation we just had, the premises of the argument against abortion do not by themselves compel such a stance. People who share the view that abortion is a profound injustice that must be opposed can reach different conclusions about whether Trump deserves their vote. Here's what they conclude the article by saying. If, however, the considerations we have put forward in this essay are sound, they preclude a vote for Biden. So what they're saying is, if you are convictionally a pro-life person, the ethics don't leave open to you the option of voting for Biden, which I think is going to be provocative to some people, because I think that's a strong statement and a strong case.
So both of these articles seem to indicate, well, French isn't making the exact same argument, but if you sort of would say being pro-life doesn't mean you have to vote for Trump, but what George and
Benoru.
Yes. I always struggle with his last name. I'm glad you know how to say it. They're saying you don't have to vote for Trump, but you cannot be pro-life and vote for Biden, which is not the same thing as saying you have to vote for Trump.
Right, correct. Right. So yeah, what I'm saying is the reason I like these two articles is because I think they put forward some important questions for Christians to mm-hmm. ask wherever you find yourself right now in sort of your thinking about the election, because they're sort of saying, hey, if you're thinking Trump, you got to ask the question, why? And if you're thinking Biden, you got to ask the question, well, are you pro-life? Because that might create some problems for you. And so I just like that they're framing up important questions that I think we as Christians need to consider.
So can I propose a question and have you guys
answer
a few dots and have you maybe. Guys either answer, dismantle?
Nope. We're going to conversate about it though.
So let's say I read the David French article and I see point number one, presidents are largely sort of irrelevant in this conversation. So I'm thinking, okay, it doesn't matter then if I vote for Biden because he's not actually going to have an effect on the issue of abortion. So then I take the other issues and I think Trump is a moral monster for all these reasons. And while I may not love Biden, I see him better in these things. Therefore, my equation adds up to voting for Biden. So hasn't French sort of implicitly created an argument for voting for Biden?
Well, maybe he has. I think what George and Panora are trying to point out is in doing that, you're joining your will to the political positions of Joe Biden. You're saying, I will that this person be in power and that their positions have freedom to reign, again, with whatever limited scope that might play out. And I think it's interesting that they say, you know, I'm determining who I will to be president. And so they're saying ethically, it would be problematic for a Christian to will that a pro-abortion candidate be president. Now, I think there's room for debate there, but that's mm-hmm. the case they're making is yeah. to say that's the challenge.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chris, I think you can deduce that from French's article pretty easily, but what he's mainly writing to those who would say, well, it's getting down to election time. To what you said, Bob, like I got to hold my nose and vote for Trump with somewhat of a conscience. I think he's mainly writing to those folks.
Let me read the nuanced moral argument that George and Panorama, I'm going to read a long quote from their article here that I think pertains to the question you just asked. They're talking about arguments that abortion has to be weighed against other moral evils. So for someone who wants to open up the room to say, hey, I'm pro-life, but that's not the only consideration. We got to weigh that against other things. And so they say, President Trump supports the death penalty, which a significant number of abortion opponents consider to violate the sanctity of human life. He has advocated war crimes. He imposed a zero tolerance policy at the border that had the effect of separating large numbers of children from their parents. So he's saying, so Trump has a lot of bad policies, and how do we weigh those against abortion? There are three, I'm quoting again from the article, there are three things to consider when evaluating such issues. The first is the gravity of the evil. Even if it is wrong to execute someone judged guilty of murder in a fair trial, it is not on the same plane of injustice as killing the innocent. Okay, so like, hey, if we give you an unfair trial and you're condemned and unfairly executed, that injustice still isn't on the same plane as the killing of innocent people on a large scale. The second is the scope of the evil. Abortion kills nearly 1 million unborn children each year in the United States. Executions are less common than death by lightning strike. The third is that an argument against voting for a candidate who opposes abortion is not an argument for voting for a candidate who supports it. So there's where there's
that's a helpful line.
Yep. Hey, we're making an argument against voting for a candidate against voting for a candidate who opposes abortion. It's not an argument for voting for a candidate who supports it. If both leading candidates for an office fail a threshold test of moral acceptability, it remains possible to choose an independent, write someone in, or abstain.
So I can write Chris Hemmelman in. What you're
please
saying.
Do.
Yeah.
I'll solve this problem.
Church planter president.
Yes.
Coming to you from Bellevue, Nebraska.
So as I've been thinking through this, I kind of two sort of thoughts here. I think one, going off of what French says, that the president has limited effect overall on this issue. I think it does, again, in the spirit of trying to ask, just getting people to think, I think it does open up a potential space here. You know, and again, this would be maybe a little bit of pushback on the George article, that it could create a space here where maybe you could see, hey, I can sort of morally reason through this to say, because of all these other direct ills and evils that Trump brings to the table, and if a president doesn't actually have an effect or has limited effect, I should say, that this could potentially open the door for me to vote for Biden for these reasons. And I think that's a fair wrestle, a fair question in some ways. I don't think your Christianity, the authenticity of your salvation is on the line, as some Christians I hear saying. So I think that is a fair wrestle. I'll give it that much. At the same time, here I think is the other question I would ask for people who maybe find themselves in that camp. This is not your 90s Democrat. This is not Bill Clinton on abortion, safe, legal, rare. Mm. This is not a stance on abortion that wants to sort of just say, this is a sad reality. This is something we want to minimize. This is something that we don't, you know, we just want to kind of mitigate the problem. Politically, the Democratic Party champions abortion now. There is a champion. There's an upholding of Planned Parenthood. I mean, Biden just recently said, I want to enshrine Roe v. Wade into the law of the land, whatever that means. But there's an aggressiveness. So even if Biden doesn't necessarily, if he became president, doesn't necessarily have the reach to have this far-reaching impact of whatever, there is still a moral tone and tenor to the Democratic Party now and to this particular candidate that it comes with such, it almost is making abortion honorable. It's calling what is evil good. And so maybe I'm outing myself here a little bit. I knew we weren't going to tell people what to vote for. I appreciate your wrestle. If you're my friend, if you're in my church and you vote for Biden, I'm not, there's no church discipline. We're not, you know, whatever. I love you. But there is a deep wrestle here when you're talking about a party and a candidate that calls what is evil good.
So here's the interesting pragmatic calculation I've been thinking through. If all the Christians who are pro-life and anti-Trump agreed with Robert George's article and said, okay, I can't vote for Trump, but I can't vote for Biden, so I'm going to either abstain or vote for a third-party candidate. And by doing so, let's say that happened on a wide scale, and by doing that, Joe Biden won the election, right? So like by abstaining, by not voting, we just sort of took all of ourselves out of the equation, and in the rest of the votes, Biden gets more votes than Trump. I think what Robert George is saying is, we could sleep with a clean conscience, even though the outcome is the same as if all those people voted for Biden. Mm. And the difference is that I have not personally joined my will to that candidate getting elected. Mm-hmm. I've abstained and said, hey, I don't feel good about either of these, so I'm gonna stand out, knowing very well that that might mean that a pro-choice candidate gets elected and abortion law goes in the direction that I don't want. But what Robert George has framed out helpfully for me, that helps me in some of my own questions around this issue, is that voting for a pro-abortion candidate is different than abstaining from an election and a pro-abortion candidate getting elected, because there's a, either a joining of my will to that person's election or not. And that's interesting how voting works, right? Because we realize, like, well, I mean, the whole reason the major parties hate third party candidates is because they drain votes away from the, you know, it's like, man, if you get a third party or fourth party candidate in there, that could give the person that's a major party candidate, that could really throw the election for them. Exactly. And I appreciate that Robert George's perspective here is, but as Christians, our first recourse needs to be, we cannot join our wills to enshrined injustice to a nation taking unjust action against its own citizens.
So how do you guys think Jesus would vote in the 2020 election?
I'll be honest. I think
as a king, you mean?
That's a great question.
He would write himself in.
I think he would say, render to Caesar what is Caesar. Say something cryptic.
Right. I think he would say vote. But the question is always interesting to me, because trying to transplant someone from a very different culture, a very different system into an American way of thinking is to take, because I mean, humanly speaking, Jesus was formed by a particular culture, lived in a particular way, and to pull him out of time and put him here it just feels like a high level of speculation. But if you want a simple answer, I think he's going to abstain.
There you go.
Yeah. All right. So, again, hopefully what we've done here is to give some questions for you to think through and wrestle with as you sort of, my guess is if you're listening to this, you already have some sense of like, here's what I think I need to do in this election, but I'm not sure. That's kind of where I feel like I'm at. It's like, I got some thoughts, but man, it feels like 2016 part two, where it's like, well, I got a bunch of crummy options. So what I hope this has done is to frame a couple of questions for you, and notice that both of these questions, for those of you who would lean towards supporting Trump and for those of you who would lean towards supporting Biden, both of the questions are framed around the issue of abortion. And that's intentional. It's not because Christians are single issue people or should be, but I think Robert George makes a compelling case that the national enshrining of a nation doing violence against its own citizens is a particular kind of injustice that ranks at a certain level in our moral thinking. And again, what I like about Robert George here is I think the Catholic Church has a good heritage here. I've read some Baptists on this, and they tend to go, well, here's a Bible verse, and here's a Bible verse, and here's a Bible verse, so, you know, we should do this. And sometimes that just feels very reductionistic to me. What I think Robert George does well is to say, okay, look, we're always adjudicating between a number of ethical possibilities, right? How grave an evil is abortion compared to the evil of unjust immigration laws or incarceration or a president who just says and does ridiculous things and brings shame on a country? Like, what, how do you rank those things in how you adjudicate ethics? And what Robert George has the capacity to do here, working from his sort of Catholic point of view, is to say, hey, there is a way of thinking about the relative seriousness of those various kinds of injustice. And I think he makes a compelling case that when a nation, when we say, hey, a nation should legally and with our permission commit murder against its own citizens, we're putting ourselves in a place that violates the golden rule. And he makes a compelling case for that. Again, I'd encourage you to go read the article yourself, and hopefully it will give you some things to think through. But it's not an accident that we're encouraging you to think through both these things around that lens of Christian opposition to abortion, because I do think that's a primary place where the church needs to speak with a prophetic voice in the moment and the culture that we live in. So, election 2020.
It's just a few weeks away.
Good luck, everyone.
You decide.
More power to you.
The future of our nation.
We'll do a podcast the next day after it, and who knows what their world will be like then. But we'll talk about it at that time.
Well, we're grateful that you've decided to listen to the Wednesday Conversation. And our goal every time we do this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or church leader in another context, we thank you for listening in, and we pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your own context. We'd love to hear from you, so send us an email with your thoughts, questions, or future podcast topic ideas, podcast@cdomaha.com. And we'll see you again next Wednesday for another Wednesday Conversation.